Hello, I'm Tessa Shepperson, and this is the first Landlord Law podcast. Today we're going to be talking about tenancy deposits because my guest is the director of one of the tenancy deposit companies. Tenancy deposits have been taken by landlords for a long time, and they are used to cover any damage and lost items at the end of the tenancy. For many years, there's been complaints by tenants' organisations, complaints that landlords did not return the deposit when they were supposed to. And indeed, there was a report from the Citizens Advice Bureau called Unsafe Deposit, which criticised the current system and called for a statutory tenancy deposit scheme. Partly as a result of this, the 2004 Housing Act brought in a requirement for a regulation, and the regulations came into force in April 2007. And since that time, landlords who take a deposit for an assured short-hold tenancy need to protect the deposit within 14 days and serve a notice giving prescribed information. Now, there are three tenancy deposit schemes, authorised tenancy deposit schemes. One of them is known as TDS, which is run by a company called the Dispute Service. One of them is called My Deposits, which is owned partly by the National Landlords Association. And the final one is called the Deposit Protection Service, known as the DPS. And my guest today is Kevin Firth, who is the director of the DPS. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Tessa.
Perhaps you can tell us, first of all, a little bit about yourself, your position in the company, and what your job entails.
Well, I'm the director. I'm actually a business services director, so I do look after other businesses as well as the deposit protection service. But my main role is as director of the DPS, which is the only government-approved custodial scheme here in the UK.
So you're sort of the person who's in charge, as it were, of the... Are you in overall charge of the DPS scheme?
Yes, I'm in overall charge. I'm in director of the Deposit Protection Service. We have no other directors of the DPS. It is just me.
Okay, Kevin, could you first of all explain a little bit to people about the background to your company applying for the tenancy deposit contract?
Yes, we were approached by the government back in 2005 in an advisory capacity because we operate a custodial scheme in the state of Victoria in Australia, because we are actually Computershare, an Australian company.
Uh-huh.
So we worked with them, gave them a demonstration of how it worked in Australia, and we worked together to develop the model that we've got now in the UK.
And how does the model in the UK differ from the Australian scheme?
Well, I think fundamentally it's the same in that it's a custodial scheme, so the money has to be handed over,
mm-hmm.
Except that ours is predominantly online service. Whilst in Australia, it's not online at all. It's all paper, and it's based on matching signatures,
mm-hmm.
Which is what we don't do in the UK. We don't match signatures at all.
Okay. Now, we've had a number of questions from readers of my blog and members of my site. And the first question is from Jennifer, who says the DPS overview leaflet says deposits are segregated in accordance with FSA client money regulations. As such regulations preclude taking risks with client money, how are you funding DPS in a low-interest environment without charging fees?
Yes, that's a good question, and we sometimes get asked this. Of course, the money is very safe and it's protected under the client money regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And when we took out the... When we first started the scheme, rates were very high and we could pay interest to tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And when rates got above 2.32%, we were legally obliged to actually pay interest. Once rates dropped below that 2.32, then we no longer have the requirement to pay interest anymore. But to answer Jennifer's question, having access to the to a large amount of deposit money means we can demand higher interest rates.
Mm-hmm, I see. OK, Okay, so if you're a landlord and you are taking a deposit from your tenant, which majority of landlords do, can you talk a little bit about the advantages of using the DPS over the other two insurance-based scheme, and perhaps talk a little bit about the difference between the two?
Well, the DPS is... what it means is that the deposit money is handed over to a trusted third party. And I think tenants quite like the fact that the landlord's not holding on to the deposit, nor is the agent. And certainly our feedback from agents is that they also quite like it when tenants come in and ask who's got the deposit. And they say, well, actually, it's held by a trusted third party somewhere, so we're not sat on it ourselves.
Yeah, I have to say that I've also heard of situations where it's been to the landlord's advantage when they're using an agent, because if the agent does a runner, they don't do a runner with the deposit money.
Yes, there is that, but if that can happen for unregulated agents, landlords do have an exposure. If they're not a member of ALA or RICS, they're not protected by the ALA bond. So if the letting agent does go bankrupt and they're sitting on the deposits, then all that money disappears with it. So using the DPS, it does give the landlord greater protection.
Because the two other schemes, the two insurance-based schemes, although they will protect the position of the tenant, they don't protect the position of the landlord. And I have known that those schemes have required a refund from the landlord of the money that they've had to pay the tenant when the agents have run off with it. So that's a good reason for using the DPS.
Yeah, exactly. They do chase the landlord to reimburse them for the money they've paid out to the tenant.
So if a landlord decides to use the DPS, what does he need to do in practice to get his deposit protected? And I've got a question here from Elizabeth Patterson, who wrote in, I protect all my deposits with the DPS, and I issue the tenants with a tenant's leaflet and the DPS terms and conditions, both downloaded from the DPS website. I also issue prescribed terms, which states names and addresses of tenants, the amount of deposit, and so on. And she asks, is she doing everything that she should be doing? And she says that it was the RLA, the Resident Landlord Association, who told her that she had to provide the prescribed terms, not the DPS website.
Well, yes, the prescribed information is a legal obligation on the landlord to supply, not the scheme administrator. Mm-hmm. So I think the RLA are right to say that the landlord should be supplying it. But there is a template on our website which you can download to complete the information and give that to the tenant. But it's not an obligation on the DPS to do that.
So what's the procedure that the landlord has to go through practically? They think, right, I want to use the DPS. What do they do next?
Well, the first thing to do is to register. You can do that online or you can ring up. Mm-hmm. It takes a couple of minutes just to register your details. And then when you've taken a deposit from a tenant, you then get 14 days in which to protect it. So if you can use the DPS, you can log onto your account, set up the tenancy with the name and address of the tenants, and pay the money in online. Or you can send in a check if you don't want to use the internet. Mm-hmm. You can send the money in the post.
Okay, now can you, if there's more than one tenant, there's this business of lead tenants, is there? Could you explain a little bit about that and how that works?
Yes, we do. If it's a joint tenancy, we do insist that a lead tenant is nominated. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason we do that is simply because it makes it much easier at the end of the tenancy to repay the money. So we'll only actually deal with the lead tenant. We do send notifications to all the tenants about what's happened when it's been protected and when it's been repaid, but we do insist on a lead tenant being named. So, I mean, what generally happens is that if there's three or four students, for example, there's normally somebody that liaises with the landlord, and by default, they automatically become the lead tenant. So it doesn't seem to cause too many problems, to be honest.
Okay. Okay, so that's looking at things from the landlord's point of view. Let's have a look at it from the tenant's point of view now. If you're a tenant and you've paid a deposit over to your landlord, how can you be sure, and what can you do if you're not sure that your landlord has protected it?
Well, I'd actually go back a stage there, Tessa.
Okay.
when you hand the deposit over to the landlord, ask for proof of the scheme that they belong to. Uh-huh. They all have to belong to a scheme, so they should have some proof that they belong to one of the three schemes.
Mm-hmm.
If they say they're going to register it, they're not a member of any of the schemes, but they will protect it, that's fine. But you need to point out to them the 14-day obligation,
mm-hmm.
that you will be expecting to receive something within 14 days from one of the three schemes. Because
mm-hmm.
all three schemes send out notifications.
So if it is protected with a scheme, they should receive a notification. Now, say that you're a tenant and you've moved in a couple of months ago and you don't seem to have received anything. What would you suggest that they do?
Well, first thing is to check all three schemes to see if the deposit is protected. I think all of them have an online deposit checker. We certainly do, and I know My Deposits do.
Mm-hmm.
I think TDS do as well. So see if it's on there. If it's not been protected, then my advice really is just to approach the landlord direct,
mm-hmm.
And ask them if it's been protected, and if not, why not?
Perhaps mention here that if the deposit isn't protected, the regulations say that the tenant can go to court and ask for a penalty or three times the deposit sum. Now I've just got a couple of questions here. First of all, there was a question I received from Rupert White through Twitter. Shouldn't the deposit programme be compulsory? If landlords can avoid it, they will. And then there's a question from Joni Farrington, who said, I recently took my landlord to court for not placing my deposit in a scheme. The judge just said that he forgot and dismissed the case, leaving me with costs. Doesn't this make a mockery of the scheme? Why is there not a mandatory penalty for non-compliance by landlords?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. It's unfortunate that legislation has been causing some confusion over its interpretation. I mean, clearly, it was intended for landlords to protect deposits within 14 days, and it's being proven now in court that maybe that's not quite as tight as it should be.
Mm.
But the message still is that they should protect within 14 days, and certainly we're not seeing any drop-off in protections, so even as a result of the court cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I could just mention to listeners that there has been a Court of Appeal decision in a case, a Tientia case, where the judges criticised the wording of the regulations and said that the best interpretation they could give it was that the landlord is able to defend and protect his position by protecting the deposit very late. In fact, they said he was able to successfully defend the case if he protected it the day before the court hearing, which is perhaps a little unfortunate, as the scheme, I think, was supposed to pose an obligation on landlords to protect it a little earlier.
Yeah.
We've got a question on that from Tim Evans, who says, as a tenant, I'm deeply confused and very concerned about there being any meaningful incentive for landlords to actually protect my deposit with the Deposit Protection Service. It seems that due to a High Court ruling, the 14-day deadline for doing so and providing me as a tenant with the relevant information is not incentivised with any legal recourse, and the DPS accepts deposit at any time after the landlord has been in possession of my deposit. Therefore, a landlord need only protect if I go through the stressful experience of taking him to court. And as a tenant, I'm not entitled to any compensation for the time, stress and money of doing this, simply to get the landlord to adhere to the law. And he asks you three questions. He says, does this suggest that the current legislation has failed? He says, would you welcome a revising of the legislation to make the 14-day requirements mean something? And do you believe that none of the above is correct and the judges made a wrong ruling?
Yeah, as I said earlier, it is unfortunate that the legislation is confused and has been open to interpretation. I also know that the government are revisiting the legislation and do aim to tighten it up.
Mm.
In fact, Scotland's just issued their regulations that have been laid before the Scottish Parliament yesterday, and they're saying it's 30 days.
Uh-huh.
Rather than 14 days, you're getting, and this will allow for landlords to sort of forget to protect for administrative reasons, or maybe if they're away on holiday or something. 30 days is what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's likely that this is going to be changed in England as well, and that they're going to change the 14-day period and perhaps alter the wording to make it a little stronger?
Yes, I do. I mean, they're certainly looking at it. I mean, they've made no decision yet which way they're going to go. But their lawyers are actively looking at it now. But as I say, none of the three schemes have seen any drop-off in the deposits being protected.
Just picking up on the questions of the Scottish scheme, I understand that there are going to be some other significant differences in the Scottish scheme. What are those?
Well, we must say that these are subject to approval, but at the moment they don't seem to have made any allowance for an insurance scheme. It would appear that it's a custodial scheme only.
And why do you think that is? Is there any indication?
Well, there isn't any indication, but look, I guess they've looked at the problems that the insurance schemes the problems that have been with the insurance schemes here in England and Wales, of all the confusion over agents disappearing and the problems that TDS had with their fees. So maybe they've thought, well, it's easier if they manage just with a third party.
I mean, these regulations are for Scotland. Do you think there's likely to be any changes in England and Wales? Are they going to perhaps do away with the insurance-based schemes?
Not to my knowledge. As far as I'm aware, they still intend to renew the licences towards, I think, at the beginning of next year, there'll be the licences come up for renewal.
OK, and for the benefit of anybody listening, we are recording this on the 24th of January 2011, so it may be at the time you're listening to this that the situation will have clarified. Okay, so let's have a look at a couple of other problems that I've been made aware of that landlords have had with using the tenancy deposit scheme. First of all, sometimes tenants are not able to afford to pay the whole of their deposit and they want to pay it in stages. Now, if that happens, should the landlord wait and protect it all in one go, or should he protect the money as it's paid to him? Or should he perhaps, do you think, not let the property at all unless he's got the whole of the deposit?
Well, look, this came up right at the beginning when we first started and we spoke to government about it. Strictly speaking, the deposit should be protected as soon as you receive it. So if you're receiving it in monthly instalments, you should really protect it as you get it. But the DPS doesn't allow for this. It was just too complex to design the system around that with the daily accrued interest. So we don't allow for it, and we cleared that with government, and it's about choice. The other two schemes will allow for it, but unfortunately ours doesn't. So you can either pay it yourself and recover it monthly, or insist they pay it all themselves, or use one of the other two schemes. So there are some choices available.
There's also problem about taking deposits very late after the tenancy has ended. There's a question from Ruth Wing about this. Why does the DPS allow landlords to protect deposits for a tenancy when that tenancy has ended? In one case I'm aware of, the landlord protected the deposit 18 weeks and 2 days after the tenancy. The other deposit schemes, My Deposits and TDS, do not allow this.
Well, I think, actually, just to correct that there, the other schemes do allow late protection. Certainly My Deposits does. You do have to pay an increased fee if you protect it late, but they do allow for it. As far as our own position goes, DPS, we are the default scheme, so we have to accept all deposits. Doesn't matter what time they come in, because we don't actually know when tenancies end either. Without seeing sight of all the agreements, how will we be able to police that? We don't know when a tenancy ends, really. So we just accept any deposits as and when they're registered, because we really only act as the custodian and the paying agent in all of this.
Okay, so a landlord can protect the deposit at any time. It doesn't matter.
Yes, I mean, look, we preferred it's early because we're funded by the interest that's we earn. So
yes.
If they protect it really late and then there's a dispute, effectively we're giving them a free dispute service because we haven't had access to those funds to earn any interest on them.
Now we've looked at a number of things relating to the deposit. Is there anything else any other points that you'd like to make about during the tenancy?
There's not really much that happens during the tenancy. My advice would be to tenants to keep the to log on to our system to make sure they can access their account on our system, make sure their details are up to date, email address and mobile phone number in case anything does happen. It's really important that we have up to date details, and obviously make sure that they keep the tenant, from a landlord's point of view, make sure that he keeps the tenant's details up to date himself. And by that I mean tenants swap in and out. Sometimes tenants leave in the middle of a tenancy. It's really important that they update the system with the new tenants, because when it comes to the end of the tenancy, we'll pay to whoever's on the account at the end, and it can get very, it can delay things if we haven't got the up-to-date tenancy details.
Right, so we've looked at the beginning and we've looked at the middle. Let's have a look at what happens at the end of the tenancy, because from what I've heard, this is where a lot of the complaints come. Many of the questions that we've received from the readers have been about the time it takes to return the deposit money at the end of the tenancy. For example, we've got a question here from Peter Allen Williams. Why is the DPS so slow to return deposits, even after having all the paperwork correct? And he says in a recent example it was about 3 to 4 months.
Yes, look, the reason why this one took so long, I did look into it. It was actually a single claim, and that's a legislative process that could take up to 3 months anyway for it to actually, well, 2.5 months for that actually to go through the process.
What's a single claim? Can you tell us
what
that is?
Yeah, the single claim is a piece of legislation that was written just to allow for, in the event that one party becomes uncontactable, i.e. disappears at the end of the tenancy, or is uncooperative and won't get involved in the repayment process. It was felt that each party needed some way of getting releasing the deposit without the authority of the other party. So there is this legal process to go through, and unfortunately it does take a while because you have to give each party an opportunity to respond. And then this is the case here. What happened here in this case was that the one party instigated the repayment, and then it just sat there, and then the other party didn't respond, because we won't do it. We don't chase them up ourselves. This is the responsibility of the landlords and the tenants. As I said before, we act as a custodian in this. So nothing happened for probably 3 or 4 weeks. Then they got in touch. Then they found out about the single claim process and went through the single claim process, which is why it took the length of time that it took.
Okay, we've got another question here from Debbie Johnson. I'm not going to read it all out because she's a little bit angry about things. She says, I and my agent have been trying for weeks to retrieve the deposit. My agent is unable to access the site properly. And I listened to her being told by one of your agents that she could input her details through my part of the site. And then she says, why does she have to make a statutory declaration to get her money back? And she's very upset about it. What would you say to people who are in the position of Debbie?
Well, look, Debbie's case, we actually spoke to the agent concerned, because this was very odd, that the agent was claiming they couldn't actually use the system. Well, there's nothing wrong with the system. The system actually works. So we never actually got to the bottom of why the agent couldn't actually use the system. But what happened was they couldn't get through, so the tenant was advised that if the agent's not prepared to engage with us, and they wouldn't, the agent wouldn't contact us at all, then the single claim is the process to go through. Once a single claim was started, all of a sudden the agent managed to access the system and complete the repayment. So all very strange, really. To me, it was the agent dragging their feet, and there wasn't anything wrong with the system.
Okay, well, the next question that we've got is from Kevin Winchester of Winchester Lettings, who is a regular reader of my blog and often makes comments. And he says, my biggest problem has been the single claim process, as it can take a while before the deposit has been repaid. Although he says that the latest change to the DPS website, where you can download the forms, is a much better process. And he said, the last problem I had is tenants losing their repayment ID codes, which delays the repayment process during the course of the tenancy. Because he said that the tenant may change contact numbers or email addresses, which they forget to update the DPS. So do you have any comments on that?
Well, the first part that we've already covered, the single claim process, it does take a while, unfortunately. If tenants disappear or landlords disappear, it does. It's a legislative process that we have to go through. So that's we can't do anything about that. The case of losing the repayment IDs. Yes, I mean we do have this happens time and time again. And my advice really is to speak to your tenant before the end of the tenancy, a month before the end. Ask them if they've got the repayment ID. If they haven't, they can get it online and order it before the end of the tenancy so it won't delay things at the end. What tends to happen is people don't worry about it until they've done the checkout and everything. They think, all right, now we're going to do it. And now we haven't got a repayment ID. So it's delayed. So speak to the tenant before the end of the tenancy.
And do they need to be careful about letting people know their ID code?
I mean, yes, they should always treat it like a bank PIN number, effectively, because it is a secret number that they shouldn't divulge to anybody, even if an agent asks for it. Now we have had instances where agents have asked for it from the tenant, but they shouldn't hand it over to them at all. If they feel that it's been compromised, then they should contact us immediately.
Okay, and your details are on the website. Now, Kevin has another question. He said, the last problem I had is where the lead tenant on a joint tenancy is no longer there due to separation, and then the second tenant takes over this tenancy, but the lead tenant has all the ID and repayment ID and won't pass it on to the joint tenant. And he said, this has caused problems, as unless the DPS terms have changed recently, they'll only communicate repayment ID details with the lead tenant. What would you recommend people do in this situation, Kevin?
Yeah, and this is a difficult one, really, when two tenants and one of them separates. We have to protect both parties, both the tenants, so it will be very easy for us just to say, okay, then we'll accept the instruction from the other party, and then we find out that the other one's still got a vested interest because they actually paid it. So it is difficult, and what we do is we tend to treat each case on its merits. We don't get too many of them, but the best thing is to get in touch with us, let us have sight of the tenancy agreement, and if possible at the beginning, whoever pays the deposit, if you could record in some way who's actually paid it. I mean, I know it's difficult. It's a bit like a prenup, really, isn't it? It is difficult, but if you could have something to say who actually owns that deposit, then it makes life a lot easier at the end.
Okay, and then the final point, I haven't got a question, but it's somebody contacted me about this recently when I think it was an agent who'd actually made a mistake when putting in the information, and he wanted to know if he could remedy this. And I just wondered if you wanted to say a few words about people actually making mistakes.
Yeah, look, mistakes do happen. But unfortunately, we only have their word they've made a mistake. Unless the other party comes forward before the repayment is processed, then there isn't really a lot we can do about it other than you need to recover it back from the tenant or from the landlord. But if it is a genuine mistake, chances are the other party will come straight forward and we can suspend it and we can make the deposit active again. But we do have to protect each party. So, you know, it's not saying I don't believe you when you ring up and say I've made a genuine mistake. But when we get a joint instruction approved by both parties, it's very difficult then for one party to phone up and say, yes, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done that. Because we've got a joint instruction, and under our terms and conditions, we have to act on that instruction. But if both parties come through and say, yes, there is a mistake, we can suspend it and reset the deposit so you can start again.
Okay, so I mean, two things. First of all, try very hard not to make a mistake in the first place. And secondly, if you do make a mistake, you need to get the other party to acknowledge this and cooperate with putting it right.
Yes, quickly. But it needs to be done quickly before the repayment's processed. Because I can't suspend it off the back of a phone call. If someone rings up and says, I've made a mistake, I can't just go in and suspend it. Because I'd be in breach of my terms and conditions. I need authority from the other party to suspend it.
Big area where we have a lot of questions at the end of the tenancy is about arbitrations, adjudications. For example, I've got a question here from Ben Reeve Lewis, who is the guest blogger on the Landlord Law blog, and he says, I remember reading that the highest proportion of cases the tenant wins because the landlords don't understand the technicalities of their application for adjudication. And he says, has this changed?
It's not changed in that it's correct that tenants are still the highest percentage where 100% is awarded, but it is reducing all the time. There's more and more work being done. Landlords are becoming more aware about what their responsibilities are around setting a tenancy up professionally and submitting evidence, because this is an evidence-based system service. So if you haven't got the evidence, then chances are the tenant will win, because it's beholden on the landlord to prove that he's entitled to some of the tenant's deposit.
Okay, I mean, would you have some advice for people about what they should, how they should approach the whole procedure, preparing the evidence and so on?
Yes, I mean, there's lots of advice on the website as well. But the thing to do is to make sure you set the tenancy up properly in the first place. There's no good waiting until the end. You need, at the beginning, you need to have, and this seems like common sense, but you'll be amazed at the amount of disputes that landlords try to start without a tenancy agreement. You must have a proper legally binding tenancy agreement. Without the tenancy agreement, there's no basis to withhold any of the deposit at all. So tenancy agreement you must have. Check-in reports, inventories, schedule of condition. Again, these are absolutely vital. And it's important that you get the tenant to actually sign and agree on the schedule of condition report, both at the check-in and the check-out stage. We do see a lot of people that don't actually do checkouts. I mean, industry best practice, you must do a checkout and make sure the tenant's present.
Okay, now what about inventory clerks? Because I know a lot of people feel that their evidence is given greater weight by the adjudicator because they're independent. Is that correct?
Well, there is. As I was going to say, all evidence is admissible. So let's start from there. You can do your own inventory and you can do your own schedule of condition report. And if it's signed by a tenant, then that's absolutely fine. The problems arise when the tenant doesn't sign it and you've done it yourself, because it's very difficult for the agent not to prove bias for the adjudicator. So if you can do it yourself, make sure you get it signed. But really, again, industry best practice is to use an independent third party inventory clerk. And then if it's not signed by the tenant, it's not as important as it would have been if you had done it yourself.
Okay, just a few comments about the actual documents and the evidence. Schedules of condition, do you have any comments on how they should be constructed and the content that they should have?
Well, just really to make them as thorough as possible and descriptive as possible. Just one word description of the quality of walls and the quality. It's not just saying good, fair, isn't sufficient, doesn't give the adjudicator anything to go on at all. And back it up with good quality photographs. It's very easy now to do digital photographs. Try and get them dated. If you can get them signed, brilliant. But we know it's not always possible. But photographs and supported by a well-written descriptive inventory.
Now, I know that sometimes adjudicators are unhappy with photographs because they're a bit vague. I mean, a scratch on a table leg or on a wall could be anywhere. Do you have a bit of advice about the actual taking of the photographs so that they are of the quality and to be used as evidence?
Yes, I mean, they need to be taken in context. So the adjudicator needs to see the whole room. So take a nice wide-angle shot of the whole room and then take a close-up of the actual damage that's been done, because it will affect the amount that's awarded. The actual amount that's awarded will be affected by the quality of the room that it's in. For example, if the work service has got a scratch on it, and you think, well, that's not too bad a scratch, and then you pan out and you can see that the rest of the room is immaculate, freshly decorated, then it will make a difference. If it could be surrounded by squalor, in which case that scratch on the work service is hardly noticeable.
Yeah. What about taking videos? Are they recommended?
All videos can be used. It's just that if you are going to use a video, try and get it done professionally so that you can actually mark where it is that the adjudicator needs to see. What they don't like doing is wading through hours of family video with dogs and babies running around and not really knowing what they're looking for. So a professional video is fine, but make sure you do the beginning and the end so it's filmed exactly the same, and you actually mark the position in the film where it is that you need to look at.
Okay. Now, we've had a blog post. I did a blog post in October 2009. I don't know whether things have changed since then, where a tenant's deposit had been paid out to her landlord because she hadn't submitted her evidence, because she hadn't received the letter from the DPS telling her what to do. Do you have any comments on this?
Yes. Look, if you're going to get involved in the ADR service, then it's really important that you need to read what your obligations are. It's no good just ticking a box saying, yes, I want to do the ADR, and then do nothing. Because if you do that, you must expect that we're going to engage with you in some way. You're going to be sent something. Something's going to happen. And what happened in this case is someone did nothing for 3 weeks. Well, to me, it's very naive to sit there and think nothing's going to happen for 3 weeks. So you need to make sure you read the terms and conditions, see what your obligations are. And this is really about people going away on holiday and stuff in the middle of a case. Now, look, we know holidays do get booked, but you must contact us because we work to very strict guidelines about evidence submission. And if you don't get the evidence in on time, then the other party will be awarded the deposit. So you need to make sure that you're aware of what those deadlines are. And if you are going to be delayed, contact us before the deadline expires and we can talk about extending it.
So basically, if you're going to be unavailable because you booked your holiday a long time ago and you need to go, you need to tell the DPS before, not afterwards.
Exactly.
So as soon as you know that it's going to be an arbitration, you need to find out what the time limits are, when you need to do things, and if you're going away, tell people.
Yes, I mean, as soon as you've ticked the box, you should start reading what happens, how it works. The landlord will be sent an evidence form. He'll get 2 weeks, and then you should get some. As a tenant, you'll get a summary of that evidence. And you should be aware, if you don't get that within 2 weeks, or just after 2 weeks, you should contact us to find out what's happening. Or log on to your account, and the status of the deposit will be on there.
Okay, so they can track everything on their online account then?
Yes, it will say awaiting landlord's evidence or awaiting tenant's response. It always gives the status of where, of the account.
I suppose they could actually do that when they're on holiday if they found an internet cafe, couldn't they? Presumably they could send you a message from there as well.
They could send us an email from there as well, or they could ring us.
Okay. Now, we have a few questions from readers about arbitrations. I've got a question here from Pauline Batchelor, who said, I thought deposits were to pay for arrears and damage, which would include cleaning, not administration. And she says that her daughter Karen rented her previous house via an agent, and on several occasions her housing benefit was delayed. And on each occasion she went into the estate agent to explain the delay, and they thanked her and told her not to worry. And when the benefit came through, she went in and paid. However, notwithstanding this, the manager sent reminder letters out to her. At the end of the tenancy, the agency wanted £150 for administration, which was £25 per letter for the 6 letters that they'd sent out. And she said that they drafted a letter of appeal explaining the situation, and the response was to ask her to prove that she called at the agency, which she said she couldn't do. So she lost the whole 150, together with a cleaning charge, which she didn't object to. And she said that she didn't think that seems fair, and she understood that such things as administration charges could only be claimed from the tenant via the courts. Do you have any comments on that question?
Well, yes, a couple of points here. First of all, it is unfortunate, but it is an evidence-based service. So, and as I said, throughout the tenancy, you should be collecting evidence, no matter what happens at the end. Or if you're popping in to see the agent and they say something like, "Yes, don't worry if it's a few days late," get it in writing. Had she got it in writing and presented that as her evidence, then she would have been fine. The agent would have lost the case. So that's the first point. Just make sure that anything the agent says, make sure you get it in writing. The second point is around whether it's fair to charge for administration. Personally, I don't think it is, but the OFT guidelines do allow for administration costs for agents and landlords to be recovered if they're occurred as a result of something the tenant has done. So if the tenant's actually made them do more work because of their action, then you can claim. £25, I spoke to one of our adjudicators about this, and I thought £25 was probably at the top end of what they would allow for writing letters. But really, it's just unfortunate that Karen didn't actually get some evidence when she went in to see the agent.
What about keeping your own records, perhaps having a diary or on Landlord Law's site? We've got what I call diary sheets, which is a sheet where they can write down the details of an incident and then sign it and date it at the bottom and keep it in the file. Would that have been of use?
Yeah, that sounds like an excellent idea. If you keep a diary of what goes on, text messages, emails, anything like that that you can submit, written evidence at the end of the deposit will greatly increase your chances of winning your case.
We've then got another question which was sent in. The questioner didn't give their name, but it's quite an interesting question. He says his personal experience has shown that all three schemes have a completely different approach to reliance on evidence provided by parties to the dispute. And he said that, do you think that the ADR process is too subjective and too often administered by non-lawyers who fail to have a sufficient grasp of the law? And do you think there should be a common standard for ADR adjudication based on set principles and offering clear and accurate guidance on the standard of proof required for each type of dispute? And he said that although the DPS provides guidance on the website, he doesn't think they go far enough and they need to be applied consistently across all the three schemes.
But this is a really good question, actually, and it is something that is quite dear to my heart, to be honest, because I did lobby at the beginning for one ADR service across all three schemes. I just felt that would be much fairer if we're all using the same scheme rather than coming out of our own rules. And the three schemes have pretty much got the same process in place, but I absolutely agree that when it comes down to the adjudication itself, then different adjudicators will come up with different ideas based on the evidence that's there. Now, so what I've actually put in train is I'm actually meeting with the other three schemes. We've already met once, and we're trying to come up with some agreed guidelines, so some high-value principles, if you like, that all three schemes will adhere to, and we're hoping to get that agreed that we can publish on all the websites.
So hopefully in the not-too-distant future, there will be a common standard that will apply across
the board. I hope so. Quite how much detail it goes into is difficult because, you know, adjudicators don't like to be pinned down to say this is how much you can actually allocate, because there's so many different circumstances to take in consideration, and they wouldn't want to be constrained by saying, right, you can only award £10 in this instance. Because there's just so many different things that can happen and that can influence that. So it is. I understand where he's coming from, and it is very, very difficult, but it's all about evidence, and it's meant to be a quick alternative if to using the courts. So the courts are still there. And also on the subject, just one other thing, Tessa, on that point as well, well, about being administered by non-lawyers. All three schemes have the same contractual obligations about the qualifications surrounding adjudicators. And what they do say is that they should be educated to a minimum of a law degree and have a good knowledge of the housing law. So you should find that's the situation for all adjudicators across all three schemes. Certainly our decision documents that we issue always start off by saying how they're qualified to adjudicate on this particular case.
Because, I mean, some people might not realise that there are different schemes with the different companies. I mean, you know, the three organisations, I mean, some people might not realise that they are using different organisations or different companies to do the adjudications.
Yes, I mean, we should be clear and upfront about who you're using. We use ours are in most of our adjudications are done internally within the DPS. We do use an external company, but most of them are done in-house. Certainly my deposits do, majority of theirs in-house. TDS are moving that way as well. So you have greater control over the whole process.
If the tenant is unhappy about the decision, are they entitled to know who the adjudicator is?
But supplying their name, I don't think adds anything to it. And we did start putting names on the decision documents, as did TDS and My Deposits. But I think it was TDS had an had someone turn up at the adjudicator's door. They tracked them down and came to their house, which at that stage I decided to take the names off all the adjudication documents. I don't feel it adds anything to it, and I don't really want their names dragged through forums and whatnot. I think as long as they actually know how they're qualified to actually adjudicate on the case is sufficient.
Now, if the parties are unhappy, either of the parties are unhappy with the decision, is there any way that they can challenge it after it's taken place?
Well, strictly speaking, the legislation actually says that the decision is unappealable. But what we do at the DPS is we will allow a review of the case just to make sure that all the evidence has been taken into account, and to give the adjudicator an opportunity to make sure that they're happy with what they've actually decided on. So we will allow one review, but after that we won't let it go backwards and forwards.
Okay.
And so interestingly as well, Tessa, there might be worth noting the Scottish regulations have also followed what we do at the DPS, and they allow for a review as well.
Oh,
actually in the regulations.
So if people want to review, what should they do? They should write to you?
Yes, there's an email address on the website where you can review if you think some of the evidence hasn't been taken into account, or the award is lower than you'd expect. I mean, it's that very unlikely it'll be the actual decision would be overturned unless there's been a mistake with the calculation. But if there's been an error in the process, then we at the DPS, as you know, will always put our hands up and make right that wrong if we have done something wrong.
Yes, and I would say to listeners that I've known several occasions when I've pointed something out to Kevin where I've received information from perhaps one of the readers of my blog, and you've always investigated, and if there's been a problem, you've always sorted it out. So the DPS will do that, I can confirm that. So there's one review that's allowed, but they're not entitled to challenge it in the civil courts then.
Well, they can always go to the courts. You always have the opportunity to go to the courts. But it's very difficult for... I would advise against it, to be honest, because the judge will say, well, you've been the subject of an adjudication.
Mm.
The whole point of the adjudication process is to keep them out of the courts.
Mm.
But you always have the... You can always take somebody to court.
Leading on from that... it is possible, if the parties don't want to go to adjudication, to take the case to the county courts in the first place. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I need to say that you can only use the ADR service if both parties agree. If consent is not given by one of the parties, then you've always got the option to go to court.
Okay, because I remember a couple of years ago, I had a tenant who wrote to me. And I did a post on the blog saying that she had gone to the county court, and I think the reason she went to the county court was because, as you say, the landlord refused to agree to the adjudication, and she won, and she got a county court order, but the DPS refused to pay because they weren't actually named in the court order. What do tenants need to do, or landlords need to do in these circumstances, Kevin?
Yes, I mean, the legislation is quite clear. It says that the DPS, or the scheme administrator, needs to be satisfied that the court order refers to the deposit. So our interpretation of that is we like to be named in the court order. So that's just one of our terms and conditions, is that you make sure that the judge does do that. 99 out of 100, that happens. Occasionally we get someone, that case that you referred to, where they haven't, and then, in which case you can get you can go back to the court and ask them to amend the order. And look, we will look at it. We're not deliberately trying to hold back the money, but we will review the case. And if there's any way we can actually accept the court order without going back to court again, then we will do. But the legislation does say that we have to be satisfied, because the deposit could already have been paid elsewhere. So we need to make sure that we're actually paying the right money back to the right people.
Okay. Right, well, we've taken the deposit from the beginning to the end, and I think we've covered most things. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Kevin? Anything you think that we've left out, or points that you'd like to make to listeners about tenancy deposits?
Well, look, I think we've covered everything, as you say, Tessa, but there's a lot more information available on the website. As far as the adjudications go, we do offer courses for agents, and we've got one for landlords coming up shortly as well that we're putting together. Mm-hmm. So we are helping landlords and agents with giving them some support to help them through the mm-hmm. ADR process. But I guess my real message to agents, landlords and tenants is to speak to each other and try and engage before the end of the repayment, before the end of the tenancy, so that you don't delay it. Find out where the repayment ID is, how they want to manage the process. Try and do that before they actually move out of the premises.
So be a Boy Scout and be prepared.
Exactly, exactly. It's good to talk.
It's good to talk. Well, thank you very much indeed, Kevin, for talking to me, and I'm sure the information you've given will be of great interest to all listeners who are either landlords or tenants. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Landlord Law Podcast with Kevin Firth in conversation with me, Tessa Shepperson. To find out more about the Deposit Protection Service, please visit their website at www.depositprotection.com. You will also find a lot of information about tenancy deposits on my blog, the Landlord Law Blog, at www.landlordlawblog.co.uk, and also on my membership site, Landlord Law, at www.landlordlaw.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and watch out for the next Landlord Law podcast.